This is Texas Grassroots Alliance live stream, and I'm Neil Aquino with the Houston Democracy Project, Alexander Montavo with the Texas Grassroots Alliance.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Tarrant for Change, our guest, Egberto Willie of the Politics Done Right broadcast in Houston, KPFT. But we're discussing today his book, Tribulations of an Afro-Latino Caribbean Man. Hello, Egberto.
Thank you for having me, Neil, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to discuss my new book.
You're always providing opportunity. Your show is extremely open, and your two shows always provide opportunity for activists, for grassroots folks, for rank and file folks. You even occasionally have an elected official on. We haven't stooped so low here at Texas Grassroots Alliance live stream, but maybe someday we'll take the plunge. Egberto, tell us who you are.
Well, I'm Egberto Willis. I'm originally from Central America and Panama specifically. I came to the United States in the early 80s, late 70s to go to college. I did my stint out here as usual. I did all the things that I needed to do to get my degree. And what I did with that, you know, people always see me with this smile and I'm always positive with everybody, etc. And mm-hmm. Some have the tendency to believe that what that means is that, well, I'm that special kind of black guy that doesn't have any issues. Sure. Well, I always tell people that no. Disposition have little to do with the tribulation one has to go through based on who they are. And I use the book as an opportunity to point that out for all sides, not just white folks or black folks or everybody in between, but to let folks know there are tribulations that we all go through. And the book is really meant for every single person to see what an individual can go through and how one can supersede that.
And so, and you're juggling so that the title, Tribulations of an Afro-Latino Caribbean Man, there's about three identities in that, right? And you're an American citizen. So there's
and
another
I'm a identity. Citizen. Yeah. You see, I walk out of a car. I'm a black man. That's all anybody see. If a cop stops me, I'm a black man, you know? So I suffer whatever grievances that pigmentation gives me. But then there are some issues also where I am a Latino. I'm a Spanish-speaking country with Spanish culture, etc. You know, I don't share all the same cultures of my black brothers and sisters in America. And I'm also Caribbean. Which also has its own flavor of identity. So I sport them all. And then lastly, I'm an American. And I believe in the country and I want to do for the country just like any American wants to do.
Right. So you grew up in the Canal Zone, proximate to the Panama Canal Zone, correct? In it?
It's amazing because, I mean, people just love to hear, wow, the canal is this great operation, right? When I was 5 years old, I could walk up a hill and look down and watch the ships go through something called the Culebra Cut, which is the biggest cut between mountains that was done for the Panama Canal, and watch the ships go through. Okay. What tourists do there, I did whenever I just wanted to go up a hill and take a look.
So were you, so John McCain, for example, was born in the Panama Canal Zone.
Yes. In as much as John McCain was born in the same exact hospital that I was born in, right, Pocosolo, guess what? He had an American passport. I have a Panamanian passport.
So did the law, why? If he was born on American soil and you were too, What was the law? What was the difference?
The Canal Zone is actually wasn't American territory. It was leased to the Americans, just like they lease bases in Japan or lease land in France and all these other places where we have bases. That's all it is. So notice that Whenever you are born in France, or if you're born in Germany or whatever, you go to the consulate to say you were born of American parents. So you want to ensure that your kids are native born citizens of America, even as they were born in foreign in a foreign country. And that's what gave McCain his U.S. citizenship and not Panamanian citizenship, because in reality, he's a Panamanian.
If you're old enough, you remember the fuss over the Panama Canal Treaty, right? It was Jimmy Carter took a lot of political heat, and Ronald Reagan, he wanted to give it back. And Ronald Reagan said, we paid for that canal, right? It was a jingoistic, nationalistic issue.
It is amazing, because the reality about the canal is stark. I mean, Panama wasn't a country in 1903. It was actually a province of Colombia. Mm-hmm. United States asked Colombia to build the canal. Colombia said, hell no. The Lesseps and France was already attempting to build a sea level canal then. But then, the United States, remember, speak softly and carry a big stick.
Right.
United States got some rebels in Panama to create a revolution and to stop Colombia from enforcing their territory. They parked a battleship outside in Colón, the city that I'm from,
right,
to let Colombia know with no uncertain terms, Panama is a new country. United States recognized them immediately in 1903 and signed the treaty, the Panama Canal Treaty, in 1903 with people that weren't actually Panamanian.
Did you interact with Americans? Was there a...
Yes, I was born on the canal, so my parents lived in originally in Colón, and then when my father got a bigger job, he then moved into the canal zone. And so while in the canal zone, Panamanians lived together. There was segregation. Panamanians lived together in communities that were actually substandard now that we know it. But and Americans live in other sections like Margarita, Gatun. Those places were for Americans. Arco Iris, Rainbow City, Corner were for Panamanians. Now, they also had two different school systems. Our systems were called the Latin American school systems. The system for the Americans were the standard American system. They made sure that the Panamanian kids and the Panamanian folks didn't really interact.
So you came to America. Why'd you come to America?
Because America really has some of the best universities on the planet. And, the selling point of America is actually great. And again, the universities are great. And what most Panamanians are that went to the canal zone, the next place that they usually come to is the United States for an education. If they don't go to the Panamanian universities and decided they want to sort of expand their horizons, a few would also go to Brazil or Spain, but most actually came and went to the United States, because again, the United States has a great college education system that has always been very well funded. Not so much as now, but has always been very well funded.
So you went to UT, you went to University of Texas, Austin.
Yes. Interestingly, I came here on a music scholarship to be an engineer.
Okay.
So my professor on the Canal Zone had a good friend who ran the band at Blinn College. So that director gave me a scholarship to play the tuba and the bass guitar in Blinn. But I couldn't take, I always knew my horizons were, I wanted to go somewhere else. So after being 1 year at Blinn, I applied to A&M, UT, got into both and decided to go to UT.
How do you get started with a tuba? Why'd you play the tuba?
Back in high school, I was our band had one tuba player, and I was a big guy, and I played the tuba, and we marched with the tuba, we did everything. So I started out playing that in high school.
As a lover of the band program and being a former band student, there's a known knowledge that you always respect the tuba players. There's something
yes.
about tuba players that are the coolest. They carry the heaviest instrument.
Yes.
And so it tells you a lot about a tuba player, because they are high quality folks.
I love Alex, man. You the tubas, that's right.
right. Are there tuba solos? Is there music specifically written for tubas?
Yeah. And in fact, if you listen to a whole lot of Mexican music, you have the Mexican music that usually has a good starring tuba line, you know, and definitely.
I wish you could remember the name. There's a New Orleans-based brass band that plays a lot of tubas, and they do a hell of a cover of Joy Division's "Love Will Tear Us Apart" with tuba. It's just great.
I got a quick question, Egberto. Neil, I wanted to ask Egberto something. You know, there's this musical connection, right, with the Latino culture. Your book is about, you know, you being a Caribbean Afro-Latino man. And you talked about how there's, you know, definitely a distinction between you and other Black community members who are born in the mainland of America and not a part of the Latino community. I would love to get your perspective just because of this history, because of the experiences you have. How has that been navigating the Latino community and the Black community? What are some of the things that you feel are crucial for folks to understand what it truly means to be Afro-Latino?
And let me add to that, you wrote of an Afro-Caribbean Latino solidarity.
Yes.
In your book, right? So just let me add a dimension to that identity question that Alex.
I think that's great, and that's an important one. I told two stories, one being at Blinn and one being at UTA. So I'm going to try to combine those two stories. When I came to the United States and I went to Blinn College, I'm a young 18-year-old kid. And you know what young 18-year-old kids look? They're looking, oh, I see a whole bunch of girls standing up here. And these were a whole bunch of, Black girls that were in the, they were cheerleading.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Or something like that at Blinn. So I walked up and I started to talk, and in Patin Mama, we call it estoy dando mi piropo. You know, I'm giving my little thing to try to get a lady. And they laughed at me, right? Because it was sort of a, this guy sounds funny and his approach is different and all of that. But interestingly, the white girls, they were like kind of intrigued, and they really wanted to talk to me and were like very accepting. And of course, the Latinas just slapped me around, you know, we'd go because we all partied together, etc. So it was an interesting dynamic that at Blinn, the women that gave me the most play then were white women. When I came to the University of Texas, the first place I went to was an institution, meaning the group that I was going to be a part of, was the Afro-American Culture Committee. I said, okay, I'm going to go to UT. I'm going to become a member of this committee. And one of the things that happened then was, it was during the Martin Luther King times. And after we all started talking, I said, hey, but I'm kind of a Malcolm X guy. I believe in not asking for your liberty, but taking your liberty, right? Taking your freedom. It didn't go over too well in that room that I said something that they took as a slight on Martin Luther King, which it wasn't. It was just saying a different tactics. And they really got into me and they were like, you ain't one of us anyway. You're a damn import. That stuck to me like, you know what? You're an import and you are not from here and you don't get it. That was the first time I got a chance to interact with my Black brethren in America and as a Black Latino to come out and then say, let me remind everybody that when the ship came from Africa on that slave trade, it stopped in Brazil, which had a whole lot of Black folks speaking Portuguese then. It stopped in Panama and Costa Rica and all these other places where you had brothers speaking Spanish, and it stopped in the Caribbean with the British where we spoke English, and it then came to the United States. Remember, they all picked us up from the same place. So while we speak a different language, we all share the same history of colonialism, of slavery, of being abused, no matter what part of the world we're from. That sort of brought me into the Black fold. I mean, But it also there were also issues then with American Latinos, because again, American Latinos didn't quite have that history. They're just now really learning about, well, I'm talking about in Texas now, about the Dominicanos and the Cubans and all that stuff. So the dynamic that one has to travel living in these not only pigmentation cases, I don't like the word race because race is a stupid thing, but whatever. When you're living in this space, there is race that I don't like, but there's also ethnicity and culture, and they're by no means the same thing. And these are things that one has to navigate. And I've given the story about a Panamanian that I grew up with, not ever thinking that this guy had white skin. He came here and I was the only person he knows, and we were kin folks because we are both Panamanian. And then he discovered his whiteness when a fraternity invited him in. And the fear that he looked at, that he took when he saw me coming, and the phone calls that no longer occurred and all of that sort of stuff. So it's amazing the dynamics that happen. And when I talk about tribulations of what somebody with this ethnicity, this pigmentation and all of that goes through, it doesn't only cover blackness, it covers whiteness, and it covers what one known as Latinidad, right? Mm-hmm. The Latin issues that are also there, because they stuff Latinos in one box as if, okay, this is how Latinos behave. A Mexican Latino ain't a Cuban Latino, ain't a Dominican Latino, ain't a Puerto Rican Latino, ain't a Panamanian Latino.
Right. And I think that's huge in terms of just the importance of this book that you wrote, that up front and center is talking about identity and talking about, you know, the impact of what identity can do in terms of the experiences you have in life. And I think for a lot of diverse communities, because of colonialism, because of the structures that we navigate through, identity is something that folks are wrestling with all the time in diverse communities in America and in other parts of the world, right, where colonialism has been so impactful and detrimental. So I think it's so important, this topic that you are bringing up front and center, that we really need to normalize more and more the discovery and also just the conversation around identity, because there are so many unique attributes to what makes each of us who we are. And we're constantly trying to fight, this desire for acceptance, right? I mean, we want to be accepted, but we also want to be able to understand who we uniquely are. And how our history and our paths have crossed. So thanks so much for sharing those stories, Egberto, and just for this book in general, because a lot of times we hide from identity, or we feel shame in our identity, or we feel like we need to model certain things we see in order to validate our identity. And it's really important that we just continue to have a space for each other where we can have these conversations. And with grassroots organizers, you know, we see this on the front lines all the time, talking in different communities. There's some assumptions you can make being on one part of town or another part of town, or being with one community culture or another. But really, when you get to know people, when you get to work with people, it really is about understanding the unique identity that we carry with ourselves and how we can help uplift each other in this work. So just appreciate that. Neil, I'm going to hand that off to you because I know you got some great additional questions, but thanks for that story and just for this work as a whole, Egberto.
So you tell a story, you're walking down and some guys in a pickup call you the N-word, and but you felt you were certain it was directed at you, and you were with some other Latino folks, right? But
yeah,
they were different pigment,
right?
So what'd you think though? Had you been called that word in Panama? Would that happen?
Interestingly, in Panama, that word was never used on me in Panama ever. But I tell you, in Latin culture, using the racial terms, I don't want to say come with a bit of endearment, but it has a different flavor. It's not mean like it is over here. Like we always talk about mi negra or mi negro or yo soy mi moreno or something like that. We, when we're talking about each other, like the, you know, we kind of gradate, give different gradations to complexion, right? But really not in a very evil way. I'm not saying racism isn't there, but it has a different connotation when it comes in the Latin culture. But there, it was shocking when the guys shouted it out from the pickup truck. And I am sure because these were mostly very light-skinned or white Latinos that I was with, they hadn't a clue of what was actually going on. I think two of them, if I remember, they were from Argentina, Ecuador, and Guatemala. Those were the three countries of most of the people that I hung with at Blinn. And so that's where it came, you know, that's when it did happen. And, you know, they didn't have a clue, but I knew exactly what was going on, right? You know, I while I wasn't called that in Panama, I saw Shaft, you know, right, in Panama.
What are some ways that you can buy the book?
One link, politicsandright.com/books, not only gives you this particular new book that I have, but the other books that I've written. So it's a good place to pick up on getting the book. Of course, you also get to the site where we do our radio show, which, of course, you have been a mainstay on, Neil Aquino. He's a beloved member of the Politics Done Right family on KPFT every single Thursday, which we enjoy. I think he has his posse over there now.
I appreciate the hospitality of you and the studio crew and the callers over there. You're done with college. What's next?
Well, that is, and you know, a lot of what I put in the book is, okay, after college is when real life begins, right? That's when you decide the employment that you're going to have. That's when you decide if you're going to be in business for yourself. That's what determines a whole lot of your life. And so a lot of the stories that I tell in the book are all the different things that occur after college. Yes, I had my tribulations in college. Yes, in college, teachers took you for granted. Yes, I stood up to teachers, etc. All of that happened. But the real life begins after college. And from the beginning, when I got into the workforce, it was all there to see. Most people, when they get into the workforce, we just accept things. We accept things for how they are. You know, the only things I accept for how they are is when I'm around a cop. And that is because, well, we all know, you know, cops are always right, right? And in our society, it seems like cops are always right. So we give them the benefit of the doubt till we get them in court, and we hope we can get dispensing then. But when it came to employment, I was never a pushover. And what I do in the book is I try to show some of the stories that happens to people for the people of color who read those stories. They're going to understand it immediately. For my white brothers and sisters who read the story, they're, some of that stories, they're going to say, God, I saw that, but it didn't even ring a bell.
And I think that's in your last chapter. You reference, you wrote this book for two separate audiences, right? You just delineated that.
Yes.
Right? So what are you, dig a little deeper into that. What are you hoping that the disparate audiences will get? And then are there things in the book that you hope both audiences will equally conceive?
Yeah, well, you notice I said two audiences, really, a people of color audience and a white people audience. And let me tackle the people of color. Like I said, they're going to read the book. And for the ones that are not, that haven't bought into the fallacies of America, that's a great melting pot already, they will get it. Now, for my white brothers and sisters, this is the kind of stuff that I want to reach at. Right now, there's an anti-DEI movement, as if we don't need that, it's reverse racism, etc., because many really don't see that racism and prejudice and lack of opportunity has taken a different form. Mm-hmm. And what I've shown, I think, in the book with all the things that have happened with me in business, employment, and just existence, a lot of things that people won't see on the outside, they'll see, oh, I can see why that is needed. Let me give a perfect example. I'm not going to give the NASA example right away, but let's just talk about me being in business. When I decided to go in business, I had a successful business. I just didn't have cash or capital. I went to the bank with a friend of mine. Both of us were going to apply for a small business loan. Uh-huh. He got into the bank. And by the way, he's a good friend, but he was a coke addict. Okay. Uh-huh. This is a white guy. And he went into the bank and they made him fill out paperwork, etc. It was easy for him to get the small business loan. I went into the bank. The guy said, "You had any collateral?" No. He said, "Don't even bother filling out the application." So right then and there, I formed my company on credit card debt, 18, 20, 25% interest sure. rate. He formed his company on 6% interest rate. Somebody can say, "Well, you know, you got the loan. He didn't. No big deal." But he got a privilege that I didn't. He could sure. build his business on 6%. I built mine on 18 to 25% credit card debt, right? Mm-hmm. So what I try to explain in the book is that that kind of stuff happens. And when we talk about DEI and the reason we have to have some sort of equity is when you see things like that happen, it actually affects your ultimate success, or your success is degraded, not based on your abilities, but your success is degraded based on your ethnicity, your complexion, who you are. At NASA, this one, another quick example, at NASA.
You worked at NASA?
Yes, I did.
What were you doing?
I was a senior programmer analyst and a senior research engineer. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, I told several of the stories in there relative to NASA, but the one that always got to me, and this one is sort of, people think it's simple, but it is inherent to how people are treated, right? I am at the place, and I have my cubicle. John Day has her cubicle at the window, and I never thought anything of it. But when she quit, I go into my boss's office and I said, "Hey, anybody had dibs on her office yet?" Which was at the window. And he said, and this was in Clear Lake, "No." So I said, "Okay, I am making the first dibs for that office. I want to move my office to her office now that she's gone." He turns around and he looks straight at me and he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, Egberto, the window offices are relegated to seniors." But guess what?
Senior staffers.
Yes. Yeah. I was a senior, not knowing that I had the worst cubicle even as a senior, and the seniors there that were white had window seats and cubicles. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a clue. So he just came out and blurted that out. And I smiled and sure. I said, "Oh, I'm a senior." And he got red face and he stopped it. I stopped him and I said, "I don't know what you're going to do." And I walked out of his office. I went to my briefcase, picked it up, walked out of the building in Clear Lake, jumped in my car and started off. I lived in Houston. I worked in Clear Lake, drove home. By the time I got home, a call came in to let my wife know. And my wife thought something was hell of a wrong sure. to let me know that, "Oh, by the way, it's yours." But the issue is, why do I have to go through things like this? Right. So those types of things are a constancy, but it's a constancy in the lives of POCs right now. And even look, there are good people out there that do the right thing, but too many of us are faced with the right thing not being done. And in that process, most people just acquiesce to it. They're quiet about it. It's something that I was never quiet about. I would do things at the risk of losing my job, including a time when all the Black and Latino folks would meet up at my cubicle and we'll be shooting the bull and all that kind of stuff. We had Africans, we had Latinos from just about every country. We'll just talk and we'll have these types of conversations, you know? And I remember my boss coming down to the aisle and he had his cigar. "What the hell are you running here, Egberto? The damn NAACP?" You know, it is the things that you have to go through in these systems. And nobody talks about it because, well, you talk about it, you know, what's going to happen? I was one of those crazies that I think I was too crazy for the 5 years I worked in corporate America. I think I was a bit too crazy to get fired because they didn't know what it meant. You know, if some, you know, they really didn't know what it meant.
And I think it's important for folks to not only hear that kind of experience, Egberto, that this is a reality for so many people of color, but that white supremacy exists everywhere that we go. This myth, the destructive myth of white supremacy exists. And you're in a place, you know, that's NASA, right? That people mm-hmm. would think they're here to do the greatest things together. You know, the best minds, the best ideas are going to win here. And yet we see the destructive myth of white supremacy. And I think it's important for folks to know, for grassroots organizers, this destructive myth also exists. And so when people are doing grassroots organizing, especially within a progressive, you know, with a progressive perspective or the progressive outcome that's being desired, which, you know, the best way to, I think for myself, this is the way I define progressive, is we want systemic change. There is systemic change that's needed in order for us to have the changes for community members, you know, that can be over a spectrum of issues. But that when we're fighting for these things and when we're organizing for things, that destructive myth of white supremacy even exists there. It even exists in progressive spaces. So that just like the workers of NASA, who are people of color, who, you know, you saw will just kind of, you know, stay silent about it, you know, modify their behavior or make some adjustments. We see that happening in grassroots organizing as well. And it's extremely harmful because we're here in a space fighting for the social justice that we're trying to achieve, right? So when grassroots organizers are people of color and they're pursuing funding, we'll see certain aspects and certain mentalities like, no, I actually don't want to receive money because I don't want it to be seen that I'm doing this for the money. And if you're in grassroots organizing, you know, there is not the money we are doing this for. We are doing this for the betterment of our communities, but that we should feel comfortable getting compensated for labor. We should be comfortable challenging the status quo. And we see that destructive myth of white supremacy existing within this important work that we're doing, as you saw in your workplace, as I've seen in my previous workplaces. And it's so important for people to understand that I think when it comes to even like the political party space, why so many folks struggle to stay in that space or navigate it is because they are sidelining diverse voices in a number of ways that continues to have them put in a place where they're not getting the results that they want. They're not getting outcomes that they want, but it really, in order to get those outcomes, it's got to start with the organizing, the trust, the relationships, the community that's going to get us to a better future. And so I think that example for me is like touches right on a nerve of what we see day in and day out. And I'm curious to kind of, as you reflect on that experience in the book and reflect on this experience, you know, here on the live stream, how do you still see that showing up in organizing spaces and the work that you're doing today?
Oh, I mean, you touch on a very important thing when you talk about it. It even comes with contributors to grassroots organizations, right? I want to put this in the right context. I have in politics done right. I'm going to kind of shift a little bit, if you allow me this.
That's your program.
Yeah, that's my program. Politics done right, and it is well designed. It is connected using social media networks, and it's a complete turnkey thing, right? And the truth of the matter is, I'd love to expand that because, as I told the group yesterday, we should have the mainstream media is not for us progressives because we don't fit the neoliberal profile. So it is something I would love to replicate by the hundreds. We'll have a lot of folks doing these things, and then we get that intersectionality right. of different folks right. doing it. I'd love to do that.
Right.
But all of that takes funding, right? And I find it interesting that people that don't have that entire picture. And by the way, when I talk about having the picture, I'm not only talking about having the picture of what I'd like to do, but having the picture of what I am doing. So it's actually effected already. The procedures is there. The interactions are already there. I have a small group of people that believe in what we're doing and do some support, but it doesn't near cover everything. And based on what I know, you know, people always talk about progressives being the way progressives are. We believe in inclusiveness and that sort of a thing.
Sure.
You would not imagine what percentage of my supporters are actually on the conservative domain as opposed to the progressive domain. And I see so many progressives out there. And I don't want to disparage this, but I want to say it in a form that says that, you know, they do here and there stuff. And they get easily funded, right? But somebody like my complete turnkey system fight like hell to first get respected and second, trusted that they feel you deserve to have this. I hate to put it that way, but again, like I said, I keep the smile on. I don't lose the hope, but I do understand that much of the tribulations that I have, even in the activist world, isn't a conservative thing. It's a ethnicity thing. Mm-hmm. It's a POC thing. That if somebody had this type of operation, nobody would think twice in saying, wow, this is something we can build on. Mm-hmm. Because you've shown that with one person, you can have all these permutations going. Imagine if we could duplicate that, if it were done in another embodiment. I am very sure that it would be very well funded. But again, tribulations of an Afro-Latino Caribbean man, and the most important part, racism didn't stop my smile, hope, or journey forward. I'll continue the activism. I'll continue pushing the message. I'll continue making sure that we lift people up. We have great people like Neil Aquino and yourself doing the work and understanding the concepts and trying to push the concepts. And that's what we got to keep doing, irrespective of all the things. But one of the things I hope to do with this book is to let people see, look, when these things occur, first of all, for those who are doing it knowingly, hey, we get it. We understand where you're coming from. And with the hope also of enlightening those who don't realize that these things happen.
Yeah, I will. Right. I'm glad to say that. And you moved to a neighborhood of Houston called Kingwood. What's Kingwood?
Why'd you go there? Kingwood is a nice woody community that when I moved here in 97, I think, was pretty damn white.
And it's part of Houston. Just to make sure, it's a part of Houston. It's one of those places where they don't necessarily want you to know that.
Right.
But it is.
It is a part of Houston, and they raised hell when Houston annexed them because they wanted profit from the oil business that is centered in Houston, but they didn't want to be associated with those people. They're a bit too different. They're a bit too, well, you know what.
Right.
So they raised hell as they were annexed. But remember, there ain't no Kingwood without Houston.
Right.
There aren't these high salaries of these folks who live in Kingwood if there was no history. You see, those are the things that people don't think about that activists like yourself make people realize. But anyway, so I came to Kingwood, and yes, it was a very, at that time, I mean, it was much, it is still a very white community. It's not as much right now. I mean, it's not, it still is, but there are a lot of people of different ethnicities that are moving in that I moved in since then. But one of the reasons that I moved here is not only that it was beautiful with the trees. I love the trees. You know, it was kind of green in the wind in the summer like it is in Panama. Not as green, but kind of green. Right. And also the school system was very good. So I wanted my daughter here for that purpose.
There was extensive flooding in Kingwood, wasn't there, for Harvey?
Yes. And interestingly, in as much as Kingwood didn't want to be a part of Houston, Sylvester Turner, one of the first places he came was to Kingwood to make them whole.
Do you think, you may not know, but do you think other neighborhoods in the city got an equal treatment?
No, absolutely not.
your just for neighborhood. The audience, Mr. Turner, Black Democrat, mayor of Houston at the time.
That is where people have to understand ethnic dynamics in cities, and it is complex. You know, it is like, you know, people always talk about integrating the police force, right? They always talk about getting more Black officers on. Do you think I fear a white officer more than I fear a Black officer? Do you think I fear a white officer more than I fear a Latino officer? I fear a Latino and Black officer much worse than I fear a white officer.
How come?
How comes? Because it's the system. The system the system tells you that that Black officer and that Latino officer feels more accepted if they can show that they have really given it to those who look like them because they are now a part of the family. It's a dynamic very few understand. But I've seen, if you have any doubt about that, remember what happened, I think, in Tennessee, the kid that got beat the crap out of.
In Memphis. Yeah.
That's all you have to see as an example. Or if you take a look at every time you see white cops beating up Black bodies or POC bodies, see how many of them actually say, back off a little bit. Never happens. So we have to understand the dynamics of power, and that is what few understand.
Chapter 19 of your book, The Intersectionality of Police, Justice, and People of Color, right?
So this is
something you've consistently talked about, and you have talked about encounters that you've had pulled over.
Yes. In fact, I spoke about that encounter when this white officer pulled me over, and I'm very respectful to officers,
right. Period.
I mean, they have the gun, and they have the DA generally on their side. So I understand the power dynamics. So I'm always respectful to hold I make sure and let them see my hands. And I spoke to this guy. This guy was smirking because he saw how careful I was. He had no fear of me whatsoever.
This was in Houston. This was near the studio, right?
This was near KPFT.
In the Houston neighborhood, inner loop.
Inner loop neighborhood. And I really got stopped just for who I was. And I understood that. And he gave me some ridiculous reason that he was stopping me, but I knew it was really to check me out, and that's fine. So he stopped me to check me out, and, you know, I was respectful to him, and he was very, very respectful to me. And for me, it was shocking. So I drove off, and then I drove back in, maybe a stupid thing to do, but I did. And I said, hey, can I get a picture with you? Because I was so really taken aback that this officer was nice to me. I took a picture with him. I went to the studio. I talked about it. I wrote a blog about it. The guy got a community commendation after the blog came out and went viral. And, you know, the sergeant called me up, wanted, you know, all this kind of stuff, because here it was. I gave this white cop a good kudos for treating me like a human being. When I talked about that at KPFT, liberals wanted to have my ass.
That was my next question. Yeah. How'd that go over? Yeah.
Go ahead. Ask it. And
I asked it. You were answering it. Go keep going.
Yeah. They hated me for actually giving a commendation, giving a good works to the cop who then got a commendation. He said they should have, that's their behavior that they should have in the first place. And my liberal friends, my progressive friends were right. But like I put in a subsequent blog, I said, look, just maybe if we start commending these guys for doing their job, we will save a few bodies, because they will get to see how it feels to be treated well, to get treated well.
And when they do badly, to get treated badly. And Alex, seems like you might have a question. You make a point on the show to treat on KPFT, the 6 o'clock broadcast, Politics Done Right, KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas, and to treat conservative callers well. You have a continuous stream of conservative callers, so Yes. Obviously they feel welcome.
And right? I want everybody, conservative, liberal, I want everybody to feel welcome, because my thing is, if we're talking to each other, we're not fighting. So my show doesn't care about ethnicity, ideology, race. None of that matters. Everybody, I always say, you're all my friends, right? No kidding. And I don't mean that. For me, that is not, for me, it's real. If anybody who knows me knows I have this Latino thing, I come and I'm giving you this big hug and a big back slap, no matter who you are. Get in trouble during the Me Too for a little bit, because everybody loved it till I found this one progressive girl that she was in a line of people hugging me and doing things. And when she came about, I went ahead and hugged, and she pushed me over and said, I don't do that. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, shoot, my God, what did I do here? Me Too, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, so I stopped doing it. I stopped the hugging way that nosotros somos de Panama, that kind of a thing. And then my friend started to say, what the hell happened to you, Egberto? You're not the same jolly guy anymore. How do you make one person, and at that a damn progressive person, one person change who you are? Then I decided, okay, I'll try to just kind of look a little bit more if the person is getting hesitant when we behave the way we behave. So that's about it.
Alex, what do you got?
Yeah, I think this topic between the interaction with officers and talking about the distinction between, you know, different officers, whether white, black, or Latino, and then also just this interaction just continues to highlight for folks the just absolute complexity of navigating the world as a person of color, but also all of the identity and ethnicity and cultural impacts around what develops behavior and what develops our approach and develops our thinking. And we really limit ourselves when we try to get a groupthink approach implemented around any issue or around any interaction, because it's actually through our diverse interaction, our diverse ideas, our diverse backgrounds, and how we're, you know, developed different behaviors or approaches or things like that, help us discover what is the path forward, help us test out and think through different ideas. And I think a lot of times we restrict ourselves when we overly condemn a singular act when someone is navigating this immense amount of complexity that you've been highlighting throughout this conversation, Egberto.
I want us to be in a position where everybody is allowed to make mistakes. Whatever kind of mistakes it is, ethnic mistakes, racial mistakes, I have made them. Okay? Sexist mistakes, I have made them. I want people to know they can make these mistakes, but I also want to make sure that people have a place to land. In other words, engage, do these things, be around folks, screw up. And I want the people who are the ones that are aggrieved to be able to be thick-skinned enough, strong enough to say, I get it. I can actually work with you and say, hey, that what you've done is not right, and that you learn from that. Now, if you keep doing the same kind of stuff that harms people or that shows some sort of a supremacist being, whether it's male supremacy, white supremacy, any kind of supremacy, then after a while, you know, we dump you. But we have to give, I don't know what I don't know. Most Americans are reared a certain way. You can't ask folks that's been reared under the cancer that was created since the inception of this country to know everything. So I think the first thing comes in understanding that. And I talk a lot about that in my book. The first thing is understanding where people come from. The other book that I wrote called It's Worth It, How to Talk to Your Right-Wing Relative, Friends, and Neighbors. It's about, first of all, getting people to trust you. Secondly, after they trust you, giving them the reality that you accept that they'll make mistakes because you make mistakes yourself. And then the other thing is that they have a place to land. The white supremacist, the KKK person or whatever, many of them don't want to be there. They're there because that's their home. That's what they know. And if they felt like they had a place to land, that they could still have an existence outside of where they're comfortable, it'll open the doors, not for all, but some to come and join you. And in a democracy, that's all that we need.
You took a turn to kind of a full-time activism.
Yes.
Why'd you do that?
I was always a talker. In other words, I always was a radical. From people will tell you from being in high school. When I got to the University of Texas, I marched with the group that says, let's get the University of Texas divestiture out of the South African apartheid regime. Those are the kinds of things that I did. When I joined corporate America, I had to be quiet. It was difficult. I used to blog, and they weren't called blog then. They were called CompuServe. That's before your time, Alex. And, you know, it was CompuServe and all those different online bulletin boards and that kind of a stuff, right? Yeah. So I used to do that under a pseudonym. When I formed my own software company, I couldn't be this radical out there either because, you know, my customers were from NASA to Boeing to all these oil companies, et cetera. So I had to watch what I say. So I also blogged under two pseudonyms that you guys could find, Tolerant Liberal and Black Stallion. You know, so I did under these blogged under these different things. When my daughter got out of high school, that I know that my activism wouldn't hurt her in school or hurt her among her friends, it was like liberating. I started to do radio first in a little radio station in Canada. Then I started to do it, you know, broke out here with the Coffee Party and some other, or Move to Amend and other organizations. I started working on doing radio and blogging and writing. And then when my website started to make enough money, I said, I really got tired of the software business. The software business made me a lot. It bought my house, my cars, my everything. I even got to put away a few bucks that I all spent now because of 12 years of activism that hadn't paid. What happened is the following. I decided to go full activism. I was making enough after I reduced all my costs to do this. Mm-hmm. And then the bottom fell out, meaning Google, Facebook, and all of them changed the algorithm that cut my income by, guess what? I'm talking about by 90%, one flip of the switch by these companies, 90% haven't recovered since. But the idea being, we all look whenever things are going wrong. We all say, damn it, this person needs to do something about that. Damn it, that person needs to do something about that. And you have to kind of ask yourself, if you're asking everybody to do something about it or somebody else to do something about it, what the hell are you doing? And the thing is, I had the wherewithal. I knew how to build a platform. I knew how to do all these things to make money elsewhere. Maybe I could do this to create a better America. Not me alone. I'm trying to be facetious, but being one of the small grains of sand that actually can do it, right? And I did that. Now, it has not been the best move financially at all, because
I resemble that remark. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But I tell you one thing about it, you know, you are making a difference. Like you, Neil, making a difference, like you, Senor Montalvo, making a difference.
And I think this is so key, what you're highlighting, this transition and the cost of this transition and the impacts of, you know, navigating the model as is and then the model changing, is that it's really important for folks to understand that the money in the industry is still there. Mm-hmm. There's millions of dollars going to candidates and campaigns. Mm-hmm. There's millions of dollars going to large nonprofits.
Yeah.
Both of them collaborate and share labor with grassroots organizers. I mean, we could highlight the number of people, Egberto, that you've had on your show and go for another hour. Mm-hmm. You know, you had AOC. You had, even in the local primary, local candidates, you had Sean Tier and Kim Ogg, who were battling over the DA position. So they value the work you're doing. They utilize the space and the audience you've built. And yet we don't see nearly enough that share of resources going to politics done right from that part of the infrastructure, that part of the ecosystem. And then large nonprofits have also benefited from your work. You know, and I know you've highlighted amazing organizations like the Poor People's Campaign, which may not be an example of someone who has all the money in terms of this work because of what they're doing as well. But there are large nonprofits who have also benefited from your work. And we really need people to understand that the decisions they're making, either in their contributions, in their donations, or in their support, makes a huge difference. And if 10% of the current market share went to grassroots organizers, we'd be set.
Roberto, wrap us up. Close us out.
First of all, I want to thank the Texas Grassroots Alliance for having me on today to not only discuss my book, but also our progressive movement. Thank you so kindly. Please visit us at politicsdoneright.com. You can get my book at politicsdoneright.com/books. Yeah. Thank you so kindly, Neil. Thank you so kindly, Alex. This has been a very enjoyable experience.
Okay, appreciative of your time. Buy the book. It's a great gift, too. Excellent Mother's Day gift, Father's Day gift, buy bulk copy of Roberto's book. Move it up the list. This has been Texas Grassroots Alliance live stream. Thank you for everyone for watching and your support, and we will be back at you soon.
We spend a lot of time deconstructing the news, trying to parse it into a form that everybody can understand. We try to find those little nitpicks where it flies above the fray, etc. If you really like these videos that we do, I want to ask a big favor. Please go ahead, number one, subscribe to our channel, and number two, please join if you can. Thank you so kindly for watching. Keep watching. Please remember to share. We must populate the entire internet with our progressive message, a message that we know is what most Americans say that they want. So help us, please, join.